Well, good morning again. Thank you for joining us here at this press conference, which is just to provide you with an opportunity to get the response to the pandemic announcement from the World Health Organization overnight. Just to give you an update, at 1 o'clock there will be a further update on cases in New Zealand. We've got we're expecting to have just over 30 confirmed cases in New Zealand reporting to you at 1 o'clock. Just to remind you that, in fact, 20 or so of those cases have already recovered from swine flu. So we have a smaller number of active cases. Currently, yesterday there were 288 people in isolation, 319 suspects and 10 probables. So that was the New Zealand situation, and we'll be giving you an update at 1 o'clock. Just a comment on the World Health Organization announcement. It's very important to be clear that the upgrading to level 6 pandemic is a response to the technical level of the spread across the world. It's not a commentary on the severity of swine flu. What's increasingly clear internationally is that this is a mild flu for most people. There are a few people who will suffer a little stronger, but it is mild, and that's where New Zealand's experience certainly aligns. New Zealand is maintaining a tight containment phase, but it's inevitable with the increasing number of international cases of swine flu that we will end up with higher numbers in New Zealand and greater spread within the community. So we're working very hard at the moment to contain the spread of swine flu. And I have to be very clear with you, this situation is going to go on for several months. The Director General of the World Health Organization suggested today that the pandemic could last for 18 to 24 months. So this is a long-haul issue. But I do need to flag with you that because of the increasing international pressure and the number of cases in Australia and North America and Europe, it is going to become inevitable that New Zealand will have higher numbers and wider spread into the community. But I don't think we should be alarmed by that. New Zealand's got good plans in place. We've got good processes to deal with this situation. And New Zealanders know that internationally cases have been mild. With me today is Mr. Brazier, who is the National Coordinator of the effort, and also Dr. Darren Hunter, Deputy Director of the Public Health, and he's got a few comments too.
As the Minister said, I think it's important to realise that the global spread of this virus is something that reflects how easily this can be transmitted, because it's a novel virus and most of the population is not immune. It doesn't actually impact to a great deal at the moment in terms of what we're doing, because we're already taking a lot of public health actions to prevent the spread here. However, as the Minister noted, because of the rising number of cases, it is inevitable that at some point we'll be having community transmission in New Zealand. At the moment, our public health services have done a great job in terms of preventing and containing any spread in New Zealand, and so they're to be congratulated, and we'll continue to make every effort to limit the spread. In terms of what we do once we start to see community transmission, we'll really be making sure that the impacts on our community are lessened. So the impacts on individuals, families, schools, businesses and the health sector. An important part of that is for everybody to take practical steps to managing and limiting the spread of the virus. So that means the sort of things that we've been telling people to do, and the sort of things that they would normally do anyway with winter bugs. So if you're sick with flu-like illness, to stay at home, don't go to work, don't go to school, but please seek medical attention if you need it. And of course, cover coughs and sneezes to try and limit the spread of the virus.
Do you have any comments, Commander?
The move by the WHO to phase 6 doesn't necessarily mean that we will change what we're doing. We'll probably align ourselves with our phase 6.1. That gives us the same range of options we currently have. As Darren said, we're still doing the same things we've done before, but the situation will evolve and we'll watch it closely and change our tactics accordingly.
Okay.
Mr. Allen, you said that the high range of the scale on the information you've been given is that up to 30% of the population could become infected. How likely is that? Is there any sort of profiling on what the scenario might be?
As I said before, this is a novel virus. It presents very similar to normal seasonal flu, and most people will get a mild illness. Some people will get a severe illness. However, the big difference is because most of the population is not immune, it will spread quite rapidly, and a larger proportion of the population will get it. Now, we don't know exactly how many, but the estimates of 20 to 30% would not be surprising.
What advice has there been from overseas regarding vaccination for this specific strain?
Well, the World Health Organization has been working with its collaborating centres to develop a specific vaccine strain for this so that a vaccine can be produced. And we're in very close contact with the WHO about vaccine production, and we'll continue to make efforts to secure a vaccine when it's appropriate.
So I'm just thinking of what happened in 76 when there was a swine flu outbreak, and there was broad vaccination and there were complications as a result of that. What consideration has been given to those potential side effects?
Well, for any vaccine or medication, it is important that the benefits and any safety issues are looked at carefully. So, yes, vaccination is a very real strategy that we're looking at because it could potentially protect large numbers of people, but we take the issues of safety very seriously still.
If it is as many as 30% of the population, a large chunk are going to be vulnerable people, does it become quite a dangerous flu then, even though it's quite mild so far?
It becomes dangerous for people who would normally be susceptible to the flu. So people who may have chronic underlying conditions or other reasons for contracting a severe illness or secondary infection such as pneumonia. The reason that we're particularly concerned is simply because of the numbers that may be infected. And of course this comes on top of seasonal flu. And seasonal flu does affect a large number of people every year. So with the additional load from swine flu, then that's going to be a concern for both people out there in the community and, of course, a strain on our health sector.
And that's a very important point, is that while it is mild, every week that we can delay the swine flu spreading in the community is another week that we can avoid much greater pressure on our hospital emergency departments and general practice clinics. And that's the reason why we're adopting this containment strategy at the moment, because it helps give us time. But we do have to flag that with increasing uncertainty what's happening overseas, that this will be under review.
The flu spreading amongst the health staff must be a major worry.
Well, I mean, it is of concern if anyone gets this flu, but in terms of the Auckland situation, appropriate steps have been taken in that situation, and everything has been done to contain that particular situation, and that's what we would expect.
I'm just going to ask a pretty simple question. Apologies. Does that mean 20 to 30% of the population will have flu at the same time?
No, that 20 to 30% would be an estimate over the course of a pandemic. So let's say that the pandemic stretches over several months, which it's likely to do, then over that period of time we could count up 20 to 30% of the population.
Yep. And all these pandemics have, as you know, a bell curve, and that's the whole population over that time.
The strategy is still containment at the moment, though. How long can you keep in that? This is going to blow, and at some point containment's no longer going to work.
Well, at some point the emphasis really has to go on to managing cases in the community. And of course there are limited numbers of resources, so once we start getting cases in the community and we have to be putting more resources into that and caring for those people, then of course our efforts at the border become less important than managing cases within the community.
At the moment you've got dozens of cases, so at what point do you give up containment? Hundreds of thousands?
We actually review that on a day-by-day basis at the moment. Because our case numbers are going up, then we're actively reviewing that pretty closely. Yep.
Is it inevitable to the point where offices will close down, schools will close down?
It may not mean that schools will necessarily close down. In areas where there's widespread community transmission at some point, then school closures may not be necessary. In some areas, however, measures to cluster control or contain may still be quite appropriate if there's limited community transmission. So the measures that we take may differ from place to place. But of course, we're also giving those messages out to people to stay at home if you're sick, to not spread it to your work colleagues, to not spread it to your classmates, so that we can reduce the possibility of workplaces shutting down. Yeah, confirmed cases at the moment have been linked to travel, either because those cases themselves have travelled or they've had close contact with travellers.
And that reflects the containment strategy that we've been running. It's almost 7 weeks since the public became aware of the Rangitoto cases. And New Zealand's been running this very effective strategy. The public health officials have done an excellent job of getting the messages out there to travellers, following up on the cases. But what we are flagging today is that it is inevitable that the number of those cases will become significant enough that we'll have to move our strategy into one of care in the community, but we're not there at the moment.
What consideration has been given to the protocols for those who provide essential services, and talking about police, about the health sector, and also around central and local government where infections occur? Are there going to be separate rules or regulations around those people so that those sorts of services can be maintained?
Well, we've got a cross-government approach to this, and for some years in our pandemic planning we've been working with a number of agencies, so they will now be looking carefully at their plans and activating those parts of their plans that they need to do for business continuity purposes.
Because I can't imagine if somebody in Cabinet, for example, came down, I can't imagine the government being able to put Cabinet in isolation.
Look, we'll follow the rules like everyone else would be expected to follow.
What advice are you receiving on effects of the pandemic to Māori? Are they more vulnerable?
Well, historically, for previous pandemics, we have seen large numbers of cases amongst the Māori communities, so it is something that we need to keep in mind. It's likely that as we start to see community transmission in New Zealand, that it will occur in different places as well. So we may see some communities more adversely affected and others less so. So our impact, our actions will probably differ from place to place, so we need to be carefully watching how it occurs.
Should Māori interaction, like Lahomi for example, should that be stopped?
Well, we'd need to look at those sorts of things, but I think communities and other people need to think carefully about actions that they can take to reduce the spread. As I said, at the moment, probably the most important thing is if you're sick, to stay home, don't go to work, don't go to school, and seek medical attention if you need to.
Colin,
30% of the population, over a million people could get flu. You've got enough Tamiflu.
Well, that's over the period of the whole pandemic, could be 20 to 30%. We've got still 1.2 million courses of Tamiflu in the national stock, and, of course, the strategy for using that reflects the circumstances that we've got. And at the moment, it's being used as part of this containment strategy. And if we were to change those arrangements, we would certainly let you know.
And in terms of, you talk about a bell curve, I mean, are we talking about at the peak of the pandemic, maybe 100,000 people might have it at the same time?
I think there's too many variables for us to give you an answer on that at the moment.
I mean, it's still fairly early days here. We haven't seen community transmission yet, and we're not certain exactly how that will pan out. This is still a virus with a lot of uncertainties around it. So we just need to be careful with our surveillance and make sure that we're picking up the numbers of cases and watch carefully how it evolves.
I mean, typically a pandemic, but when people get flu, is there a short period of time where it does affect a lot of people, or in a big tail at the end?
No, I mean, it's possible that we do actually gradually see the case numbers go up rather than a huge sudden increase. But again, there are so many uncertainties, we don't actually know.
So you wouldn't expect to see the same pattern that you do with the normal winter influenza?
We may not. But again, we just have to wait and see.
Just getting back to the Hongi issue, you're saying that at some point people may need to consider sort of contact, like the Hongi.
Well, I mean, if people are sick and have symptoms and coughing and sneezing, then they need to think about not spreading those to others. So that's covering coughs and sneezes, and I guess making sure that the respiratory secretions are not spread. So that doesn't just apply to Hongi, that applies to all sorts of things.
Well, handshaking. Hugging family, for instance.
Well, I mean, I don't think we can get into too much detail in terms of prescribing what people can do, but I think the most important things, as I've said, that they need to stay at home if they're sick, so they're not spreading it to schools and workplaces.
Yep.
What happened in Abby. Auckland Hospital as part of the containment? Are you looking at putting something in place for people who do work in hospitals with some of the most vulnerable people about a travel registry or a stand-down period, say a surgeon's come back from Mexico? Are you looking at doing anything like that?
Well, at the current time, the hospital services around the country have their long-standing plans in place, and they're continuing with those plans. I think it was quite clear from, I think, Dr. Sage in Auckland that if we were to have a process of any health worker who'd been overseas can't go to work, that would have a significant impact on our public health services, when most of them won't have had any exposure to this at all. So it is a question of responding to the circumstances that exist, but it is important to note that this is a time of great pressure on our health workforce, and that's one of the reasons why we're encouraging people, if they have flu-like symptoms, is to stay at home and not to spread it around.
Well, Minister, has Cabinet talked about any financial assistance for especially small businesses where people get put into quarantine and these businesses potentially can't run? So they start losing money?
No, we haven't looked at any specific support from the government. I have to say the experience to date, and at times we've had significant numbers of people in isolation, at one stage we had 500 New Zealanders in isolation, is that there's been tremendous goodwill from New Zealanders to be of great assistance in preventing the spread of the swine flu, and I suspect and I know that will continue.
You had two unions already this week call for employers to cover the quarantine. I mean, surely this is going to be an issue at some point.
Well, to date, it's worked very well with goodwill from everybody involved in this. And as the numbers increase, as they inevitably will, then the public health response to this problem will change as well. You may eventually see changes in our quarantine and isolation rules. So, you know, this will be changing as the number of cases change, and we'll keep you informed as the rules may or may not change.
What analysis has been done of the interaction behind the swine flu outbreak and also the normal winter flu outbreak that we get? If the two combine, what sort of pressures are predicted to go on our hospital service?
Well, as I said before, there's a lot of uncertainties around this virus. I think one of the things that the WHO has also said, that the only thing that's certain about influenza viruses is the uncertainty. I mean, they're very good at changing and adapting over time and mixing with other influenza viruses. So yes, there is potential for this influenza virus to adapt and change. So we need to be very carefully watching what it does. It's another good reason for people to be vaccinated against seasonal flu, so they don't get a double whammy, if you like, both seasonal flu and this new flu virus. So yes, there is potential for it to change, which is why we're taking this very seriously.
Okay. So look, it is a rapidly changing international situation, growing cases in Australia, widespread also in places like Japan, the United States, Canada, and New Zealand will respond as appropriate. We're running a tight containment strategy at the moment. We expect that to continue, but to flag with you, it's inevitable that our numbers will continue to grow and our response will have to change with that growth. But the public health message remains very strongly that if you do have flu-like symptoms, stay at home, don't go to school, and be in touch with your GP. So as I've said all along here, if we've got new information, we'll keep you up to date with the daily updates, and as the situation changes, we'll keep you fully informed. So thanks very much.
Okay, Patrick.